from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Sunday night, a 6.9 magnitude earthquake hit the coast of Northern California and parts of Oregon, raising the specter once again of the vulnerability of this region to a potential major earthquake. There's long been the assumption that the big one or big ones will come. That likelihood is inevitable. But now, to add to the seismic mix, we have a book by U.S. Geological Survey earthquake and volcano expert John Dvorak informing us all about earthquake storms. The author of the book Earthquake Storms, an unauthorized biography of the San Andreas Fault, joins us this Forum segment, as does USGS geologist David Schwartz. Let me welcome John Dvorak here in studio. Good morning.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad to be here.
And David Schwartz saying good morning to us by phone from Menlo Park, again with the USGS in Menlo Park. David is an earthquake geologist, and David, I've got to ask you about Sunday's quake. It didn't do much in terms of damage or anything, but a lot of people are saying, why was there no tsunami? And I guess it's because of horizontal motion or the kind of earthquake it was.
Well, that's exactly right. Tsunamis are produced by the displacement of the seafloor, and that requires sort of an up and down movement. This was a strike slip fault where the movement is lateral or side to side, so it really doesn't affect the sea bottom. It was a relatively small earthquake, 6-7. That's a very, very active area, and actually, since about 1900, within about 50 miles of Sunday's earthquake, there have been five other events of 7 to 7.3. I would say that smaller events are capable of triggering tsunamis, even strike slip events, if they produce submarine landslides. And we know from experience, probably one of the worst was in Papua New Guinea in 1998. There was a magnitude 7 just offshore. It produced a submarine slide that wound up producing a tsunami and killing 2,200 people.
Well, small earthquakes, I'm told, are more likely, or I read, than larger earthquakes. But larger earthquakes, as I've said in my introduction, seem to be inevitable in many people's minds. And in fact, I know you did a recent study of the century, roughly between 1680 and 1780, and saw that our own century has been pretty calm by comparison. We did have 06, but that's over 100 years ago, and we had Loma Prieta, and, you know, you could rattle them off here. But the fact of the matter is, it seems like when we do the kind of analysis you do, that there's a likely probability of big earthquakes up ahead.
Well, there definitely is a high probability, and right now our estimate is 63% by the year 2036. What you were referring to was a study we've done. A lot of the geologists working here in the Bay Area for the last decade or so have been digging into the major faults, and we've gone back in time, and we have a pretty complete record from about 1600 to the present. And what we see in there is a period from about 1680, 1690, up through the beginning of the construction of the Mission Dolores and the Presidio around 1776, 1780, in which literally every fault in the Bay Area, the San Andreas, the whole Hayward, the Rogers Creek, the Northern Calaveras, the San Gregorio, all failed and produced large earthquakes. So in a relatively short period of time, the system failed and released almost as much energy as the 1906 earthquake. And following that cluster, as we call it, the Bay Area was relatively quiet with regard to large earthquakes until 1906, and then that released a tremendous amount of stress, and we're still in this long, quiet period following the 1906 earthquake. But plates are moving, the faults have to move, things have to catch up. So we've got a lot of earthquakes ahead of us.
Again, David Schwartz is earthquake geologist with the USGS in Menlo Park, and John Dvorak here in studio is scientist, author of Earthquake Storms, A Fascinating History and Volatile Future of the San Andreas Fault. And John Dvorak, let's talk about earthquake storms. I mean, I don't think the public knows a lot about earthquake storms. Help us understand what they are.
Well, that's right. It's a rather new idea in seismology. It's been around for one or two decades. Basically, one of the things we've learned in the last 10 to 20 years is that earthquakes are not random events, and earthquakes do not occur like clockwork. As Dave has just mentioned, earthquakes are clustered in time and space, And when you get a cluster of large earthquakes, like 7.5 or greater, in a limited region, that is an earthquake storm.
And you did some research. I know the paleoseismology is kind of difficult here in California to really pin these things down. But we know that there were two of these storms, and they were pretty devastating. And of all places, Hollywood.
Well, yes. It's hard to exactly bring down to establish exactly when these quakes happened. But we know that the Santa Monica Fault, Hollywood Fault, Raymond Hill Fault, the Newport Fault, Pointe Hills Fault, and the Whittier Narrows and several others all broke in about the same time period. Now, in the paleoseismic, that means that they may have occurred within years or centuries of each other. But what's important is that there was this long period of quiescence of maybe 3,000 to 4,000 years. And then it ended, and they all seemed to rupture at just about the same time.
When you look at the biggest likelihood of, or the biggest concern, let's put it that way, of probability, you come down on the southern section of the San Andreas Fault in Southern California, running through Southern California. You talk about a 60% probability in the next 30 years. How do we come to those kind of figures, especially since things cluster and do turn out to be somewhat predictable?
Well, that's right. On the first thing is the passage of time. Of the entire San Andreas Fault that runs from Mendocino down to the Salton Sea, the northern part broke in 1906. Sort of the middle part, north of Los Angeles, broke in 1857. But that southern part, south of Palm Springs, that hasn't broken since 1680. So that's your first indication. The next indication is we're able to measure the buildup of stress. And the buildup of stress has been very constant. And we know that since 1680, there has to be something like 27 to maybe 35 feet or more of displacement down there. That is, the fault has to slide that much.
I don't know what we're hearing here. Almost sounds like a fire raid or something. I'm hearing it in my headphones. We'll just try to proceed here, and hopefully we can, thank you, eliminate that sound. We're talking to John Dvorak, and his new book is Earthquake Storms, A Fascinating History and Volatile Future of the San Andreas Fault. Actually, contrary to popular perception, John Dvorak, major earthquake doesn't mean that there's a decrease in the likelihood of another. This is, in many people's minds, almost an equation that just doesn't work anymore.
Well, that's right. On the general perception is, once there's a large earthquake, it's going to be quiet for a while. But again, one of the things we've learned very recently in the last few decades is if there's a large earthquake, the probability of another one within a few days goes way up. Let me try to put some numbers on this. If on any three-day period in California, there's like a 1 in 100,000 chance of a magnitude 7 earthquake. So it's pretty small. But if there is a magnitude 7 earthquake in California, the chance that there will be another one or larger in the next 3 days is about 1 in 10. And so that mostly should alert people that when there's an event, such as recently happened here in California, you don't need to panic. You just should be sort of have a heightened awareness that the ground might shake again soon.
And David Schwartz, I think it's maybe goes without saying, but California really needs. I'd asked you before about why there wasn't a tsunami up there Sunday night with that 6.8 quake off the coast of Eureka. But California really needs a system to alert people. Let me ask you actually about this, John Dvorak. Alert people that a major earthquake has occurred, that a seismic wave is approaching. I mean, it could save countless lives. It did in Japan.
Well, that's right. That's what happened in Japan in March of 2011. Japan has this early warning seismic system that if there's a major earthquake somewhere and the seismic waves are moving, we know that we can send information faster than what the seismic waves move. And so what happened in Japan is that the earthquake started to shake, and people elsewhere in Japan on their cell phones, their laptops, their tablets, up on billboards, there was a countdown. And it said in 35 seconds, the ground is going to start shaking. And people could do reasonable things to prepare for that. And that is what's needed in California.
Yeah, I think, David Schwartz, you would probably agree with that wisdom. California needs a system to alert people that a major quake has occurred, that a seismic wave is approaching.
I think that's very, very exciting. And, you know, down the road, as the technology for that really gets better and the system is distributed and everybody has it on their computers and their smartphones, I think in the end the results can only be good when we do have something large.
And what about just seismic energy overall? I mean, the stress builds up between the North American and the Pacific plates, and from what I'm reading recently, it only can actually be relieved by large quakes or a series of large quakes.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, what goes in has to come out, and the plates are always moving, and they're stressing the crust where through most of the San Andreas Fault system, it's about 40 millimeters a year, and over time that builds up, and that has to be released, and the way to release it is by slippage in the crust, and the slippage occurs on faults of all different types, and when the crust snaps and the fault moves, it releases the energy that's been stored in the crust around it. So it's the only way to go, and the plates are going to be going for millions of years, and, you know, we've got earthquakes as far as we can see in our future.
And John Dvorak, earthquake storms, again, could be triggered, as you point out in your book, by a major quake. In fact, a lot of the research on this idea, I think it's called stress transfer, comes out of Stanford and Amos Noor locally here in the Bay Area.
Well, that's correct. It was Amos Noor, a professor at Stanford, and he got this idea in 1993 when he was visiting Greece. And he noticed that many of the Bronze Age sites seemed to be consistent with earthquake damage. However, the end of the Bronze Age was not a single catastrophic event. It occurred over about 40 years. And so that's what prompted him to think that maybe earthquakes could cluster together. And there's a very good historical example. It happened in Turkey. It started in 1939. And since 1939, along the northern edge of Turkey, right along the shoreline by the Black Sea, there's been 13 major earthquakes. And this fault system is very analogous to the San Andreas. And there is at least one more coming, and people anticipate in the next decade or so that the city of Istanbul, 15 million people, is going to be struck by a major earthquake. It has not had a major earthquake since 1509.
I'm going to give out the number and invite those of you listening to join us. We're talking about earthquake storms, talking about the fact that a 6.8 magnitude earthquake just occurred off the coast of Eureka on Sunday, a reminder of another lurking natural threat. We have John Dvorak with us in studio, author of Earthquake Storms, The Fascinating History and Volatile Future of the San Andreas Fault. And with us by phone is David Schwartz, who is an earthquake geologist with the USGS in Menlo Park. And you can be with us as well. In fact, here's our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We do invite your calls, so feel free to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Toll-free number, excuse me, once again, is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Or post any of your questions or comments immediately onto our Facebook page, onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. In fact, Colin asks on our Facebook page, what are the outer edges of safety for living along the fault in the Bay Area? I'm sure the closer you get, the greater the danger. Where's the line of demarcation? Where is it safe to live versus not safe? We often hear that. I'm sure you do, David Schwartz. You've heard that question a lot.
I've heard that question before, and I think there's a misconception that if you live further away from a fault, you know, you're safer if the fault moves. The reality is that the damage is primarily done by the shaking. And the shaking is influenced by the type of geological materials that are directly below you. So you can be adjacent to the fault on bedrock, or you could be 5 miles away from the fault on a sequence of sand and silt and gravel with a high water table, and you will shake harder, and you might shake longer at that 5 mile distance. So there's all of this variability around the region in terms of different types of geology. All of this affects the level of shaking from movement on a given fault. So it's a very, very complex problem.
Yeah, and talk about where the fault is. Often, whenever earthquakes come up for discussion on this program, we get a question about the nuclear power plant in San Luis Obispo, and if there is a big one, what about the fault lines there, and what about the dangers there? You want to comment, David?
Well, all I'll say is that there are at present a lot of ongoing studies and reviews, and I don't know where it's all going to wind up, but there, you know, have been newer faults found, a fault called the Shoreline Fault, a little closer to the plant than had been previously thought. There's a lot of work going on to understand where these faults extend, how often they move, what kind of contribution they'll make to the overall shaking. So a lot of people are working on that at the present time, and it remains to be seen what the final results will be and what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to say.
And lots of calls, and I want to go to them, but first I want to go back to John Dvorak to just get a couple of maybe myths demythologized. One of them is animals predicting earthquakes. You pretty much dismissed that.
That's right. There's no scientific evidence that animals can sense earthquakes before they happen. There's a great deal of anecdotal evidence. Now, there's a difference between anecdotal evidence and scientific. The scientific is a much more rigid, but animals cannot predict earthquakes.
Another thing, and I remember the old days when people used to say, well, Edgar Cayce predicted, you know, when the volcano erupts, there will be the great earthquake and so forth. And there is actually there's been a lot of talk through the years about the connection between earthquakes and volcanoes, because indeed there are connections, but almost no, again, scientific connection between the connection between volcanic eruptions and earthquakes?
Well, there isn't any direct relationship between a major earthquake and a specific eruption. There are some which do occur in coincidence, and there's this general relationship around the rim of fire for earthquakes and volcanoes. But specific events are not related, or for the most part, they're not.
And again, feel free to join us by phone at 866-733-6786 or email forum at kqed.org. And let's go first to Scott. Scott, you're on. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And just a quick question to Dr. Schwartz and Dvorak. From Daly City North, it broke from Muscle Rock to Point Reyes in 1906. The San Andreas Fault broke. And, of course, 1989, Loma Prieta was south of that area. Is it fair to say that the section, the peninsula section from Muscle Rock and Daly City down to Loma Prieta is, say, next or primed and ready to go, or is it too hard to, like, nail down the section?
Well, that's a really good question. Actually, Loma Prieta wasn't on the San Andreas itself. It was on a closely associated fault to it. But that section, the peninsula, is actually one of the most poorly understood in the Bay Area. We know that 1906 broke all the way through there. Before that, there was an earthquake around 1750 north of the Golden Gate on that section of the San Andreas. But we don't have any real information on the long-term history of the peninsula. We think there was an earthquake on there in 1838. But the 1838 earthquake could have been further south in the Santa Cruz Mountains. We have evaluated the San Andreas in our probability studies, and we think because we had 1906, which broke the whole thing, it's more likely that down the road the next earthquake will be more limited. So, yeah, the Santa Cruz Mountains or the San Andreas Peninsula could be the site of the next, you know, magnitude 7.1, 7.2, 7.3 San Andreas earthquake.
Let me thank Scott for the call. John Dvorak, you want to add something here?
Well, the only thing that I'd like to add is that recently people have seen a cause and effect between what happens up in Cascadia, that is off the coast of Washington, Oregon, and the northern part of California.
So actually between Mendocino and Vancouver, really.
That's right. Yeah. It's off the coast. It's a subduction area. It's been very quiet seismically, but through this field of paleoseismology, people have identified about 15 major earthquakes in the last 3,000 years. And of those 15, 14 were followed within a few decades by a rupture of the San Andreas Fault. The exception to this, which just sort of adds to the curiosity, The last major rupture of the Cascadia is in 1700, and then it took 206 years for the northern San Andreas to rupture. And so there's this tantalizing idea that if there is a large earthquake up in Washington, Oregon, within decades, we might see, again, a renewal of seismic activity in Northern California.
I was reading your work on Cascadia. Again, you get into this likelihood of a rupture in the next 30 years. I think you put it at 10%. But it also brings up a question of that kind of probability vis-a-vis the Hayward Fault. The prediction of the Hayward Fault back in 1868 suggests 30-some percent, maybe low 30s, of a repeat on a large of a large event in the next 30 years also. And I'm looking at an email here, excuse me, an online comment from a listener who says, Hayward Fault could be far more destructive to human life because of the very crowded population that live in its region. The fault eruptions have an average cycle of 138 years. Last large one, magnitude 7, took place in 1868. So another large one of near or the same magnitude is overdue by about 6 years. And as the caller points out, this extends from Fremont and all across the East Bay and then under the Bay Bridge and or under the Bay and changes name to the San Rafael Fault in Marin County. But we're talking about, again, probability. You put things at 30 years, I think, in your work. He's talking about 6 years.
Oh, well, yes, there's a number of studies out there, which varies on the timeline for the future. What's important to remember about the Hayward Fault, if we're looking at the historic data, in 1868, there were about 24,000 people lived in the East Bay and were affected by that earthquake. Today, there's over 1.5 million people live in the East Bay and would be affected by that earthquake.
David Schwartz. In both of our, in the 2003 Bay Area probability study and in the 2008 statewide probability study, that in the next 30 years, there's a 31% chance of there being a large earthquake somewhere along the Hayward Rogers Creek. Those faults connect under San Pablo Bay and may rupture together sometime. So, yeah, so I think in terms of the worst-case scenario for the Bay Area would be a large earthquake on the Hayward because it sits right in the center, geographic center of the region. You know, there are 2 million people that fundamentally live right on top of it. We have all of this infrastructure crossing the fault. And, you know, we've never had a major earthquake in the center of a modern U.S. city. And we just don't really know what's going to happen.
David, I got to ask you, because a lot of listeners are bringing up the question of fracking and its effect. I guess, in fact, one listener says, recently read that quakes in Ohio may have been caused by fracking. What about fracking a fault line to release pressure and avoid a big one? But there are others who are thinking that maybe fracking is contributing to some unwanted greater seismic activity or terremoto.
Yeah, well, this is a very hot topic right now. I think there was a James Bond movie where they were going to put fluid into Hayward Fault and try and set that off. There's no question that the introduction of fluids into the ground, into the upper part of the crust, changes local stresses and produces earthquakes. I think the question now is, and most of what's been seen in terms of the magnitudes are relatively small, twos, threes, maybe getting up to fours. The question is, if you do this, can you somehow generate a 6.5 or a 7? That would be the real concern. But there is no question, we've known this since the 1970s, that the introduction and the changing of fluids in the crust affects stress and can produce and does produce, you know, small earthquakes.
And let me go to another caller. Neil joins us from Palo Alto. Neil, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Yeah. A few minutes ago, Michael, you asked about what is or should be done about an early warning system. And I think I heard your guest say the technology's great and this would be great. I don't think I heard a response on what we have right now or are doing. And I think it's obviously particularly relevant for California, not only from the earthquake zone we're in, but we have USGS here in Menlo Park. and we have companies like Apple and Google. So what is there right now, and if it's not there, what's being done on a government or a private level to have the early warning system that everyone thinks is so great?
Yeah, no, good point, Neil, and thank you for that. I mean, we're all in agreement that we need something to alert people. But, David, what do we have? What do we need?
Well, there is a good prototype system, and the USGS and UC Berkeley in particular are working on it. It needs a lot of money. State, I don't know the specifics, but the state is trying to provide, I think it's $80 million.
Hey, Facebook's giving money for police in Menlo Park. Maybe they can get money for warning systems,
too. Maybe they can.
They want to be good corporate citizens. Yeah.
I think the system is probably pretty close, but there's a lot of testing really being done right now, because what they don't want to happen is a lot of false alarms go out. And but I can't really give you the timeline of when people are thinking about sort of making this much more widely distributed. It's just something that needs to be done.
Well, this may not be a question you can answer, John Dvorak, but one of our listeners, Ted, hearing you talk about earthquake storms prompted him to ask, or to express his worry about whether or not his earthquake insurance could withstand earthquake storms.
Well, that is a concern. And, of course, these reports, which are being generated by university scientists and government scientists, much of that is being financed by the insurance companies, because they want to know what is the probability for these events, and what type of destruction, and what's the likelihood of them.
Just another quick question is, does slippage occur incrementally, or does it always require a big event, John?
Well, the main plate motion between the Pacific plate and the North American plate, almost all of that motion is taken up by these huge, colossal earthquakes. These small, relatively small earthquakes, like happened at Northridge, Loma Prieta, that's a very small amount of the energy gets released.
Thank you, John Dvorak. Again, his book, Earthquake Storms, The Fascinating History and Volatile Future of the San Andreas Fault. And thank you, David Schwartz, earthquake geologist with the USGS in Menlo Park. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.